To most of us, learning something the hard way implies wasted time and effort. Good teaching, we believe, should make learning easier. On today's episode of the Burleson Box, we speak with Roddy Roediger, author of Make It Stick, who turns these ideas on their head. Roddy Roediger is the James S. McDonald Distinguished University Professor at Washington University in St. Louis, where his research for over three decades has centered on human learning and memory. He's not only published hundreds of papers, dozens of textbook chapters, and mentored over 30 students for their MA and or PhD, but he also received a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Society of Experimental Psychology and Cognitive Science in 2016, and in 2017, he was elected to the National Academy of Sciences. It's such a tremendous honor for me to speak today with Roddy Roediger about his book, Make It Stick, The Science of Successful Learning. But first, here's a message from our sponsor. Dr. Burleson here. Many of my most successful clients find themselves looking for a way to preserve and grow their wealth without the uncertainty and volatility of Wall Street. There is another way. My good friend and colleague, Dr. David Phelps, helps practice professionals translate their high income into a high net worth. He does this by connecting members with highly curated, passive real estate deals through his Freedom Founders community. Real estate can hedge your portfolio against inflation, all while providing passive monthly income. This secures your wealth and creates meaningful freedom in your life today, not some vague retirement date in the distant future. Some of my top clients have benefited from David's support and the Freedom Founders community. David has put together some special resources for my listeners. To access, just text Dustin to 972-203-6960 or go to freedomfounders.com/Burleson. Roddy, I'm so excited to talk to you, and I love your book. For everyone who's joining us on the podcast or via email link, the book is Make It Stick, and it's just such an honor to have you here. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
I discovered your work. We spoke a little bit before we started the recording at Tufts University, had a teaching course on how to become better teachers. I'm a part-time instructor at the dental school, and I was embarrassed that I had not heard of your research before then, but you are quite distinguished in your field, and it's such an honor to be here. Can you tell the listeners maybe a little bit who might not be familiar with your work, a little bit about your background and your research lab?
Sure. I am a cognitive psychologist, and I've been studying learning and memory in laboratory settings mostly my whole life. And about the year 2000 or so, nearly 25 years ago, I took a turn to go in a more applied direction from the work I've been doing and said, if we know so much about learning and memory, maybe we should apply it to education. And I was able, luckily, to get two big grants to do that, one from the James S. McDonald Foundation here in St. Louis, another one from the Institute for Education Science in Washington. And so those helped a whole lot. And so for the next 15, 20 years, I did research on learning and memory, and Make It Stick came out of that work that I was doing with Mark McDaniel, my colleague here, who's a co-author of the book. The first author is Peter Brown, who's a professional writer.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Thanks for it. I love books that take a body of knowledge, a career's worth, and distill it for, you know, the general public for us to consume and learn the lessons. It's been great. I love that the book dispels some myths about learning. I think a lot, unfortunately, that I was taught early years and maybe even dental school. I'd love to talk about some of those. One of them I jotted down was the myth that if we can make learning easier and faster, the learning will be better. Another is that we can commonly just think that we can expose ourselves to something enough times and it'll stick. But your research dispels a lot of that. Why is it important for students and lifelong learners to really understand who's right about how learning works?
Well, I think it's critical. I mean, I wish the kind of information that's in our book were taught in a how to learn course in the fifth grade or fourth grade. It even works in elementary school children. It's been shown, not by me, but by others. So I think it's critically important. And what we're often taught, what I was taught too, is if you simply read something repeatedly, that's a good way to learn it. And, you know, it's not, you know, the first time you read something, obviously you have to understand it, you have to read it and comprehend it. But simply letting, what's important is what your mind, your brain does with the information, not so much how many times you look at it. If you do really good things with it one time when you read it, you can prevent yourself from having to reread it over and over again. So it's really what your brain does with it and helps to store it and then helps to put it in a form where it can be retrieved later. That's a critical step. So the idea that somehow if learning is easy, it's good. Well, some things are easy if we're very interested in them. You know, if a kid's interested in, say, baseball, well, baseball facts are easy to learn. Algebra facts, not so much. But for something you're not interested in, it's difficult. I mean, we all know, I'm sure, going through dental school at points was very difficult. So was graduate school in psychology and certainly undergraduate school, certain courses, especially if they're not your natural, something you're naturally interested in. So the book has all kinds of strategies for doing that, but simply repeating things over and over, which is sometimes advised, and it's often done in sports, is not a very good way. I mean, you have to do, say, in sports, you have to do that a little bit to just get the hang of it. And the same thing when learning to read. You simply have to read, I mean, different passages over and over. So simple practice is good in certain situations. But once you've got the basic hang of it, you need to do some more complicated things. So say in learning skills, for example, one thing people don't realize that they need to do is to mix it up. That when you play in, say, a baseball game, when you have batting practice in a game, even in the major leagues, they say, okay, I'm going to throw you 10 fastballs, now 10 curveballs, now 10 changeups. Well, that never happens in a game. The pitcher doesn't tell you, okay, here comes a changeup. The whole idea is you have to be able to recognize that as it comes off the pitcher's fingertips and arm movements. So you need to learn to discriminate among different skills. And if you, yeah, learn, when you first learn to hit, yeah, you need to have that kind of repetitive practice a little bit. But then once you're really getting skilled, you need to really mix it up. You don't, if you're a tennis player, you don't hit 15 forehands and 15 backhands. You need to, you know, the old saying is play like you practice and you'll practice like you, no, other way around, practice like you play and you'll play like you practice. So make it what in the jargon of psychology we call transfer appropriate processing. Whatever your task is, eventually that you want to succeed at, practice like that as much as you can.
A great, so, great piece of advice. And yeah, there's the strategies in the book are great. And you share really cool stories from airline pilots to neurosurgeons. And I think that's maybe one example of variety. Yeah. Pilots don't just practice simple takeoff and landings. They prepare in simulators and then in the real world for catastrophic things. And I'm glad they do as a passenger in the back of their airplanes. Can we talk about, I think there's been a lot of this in the news recently, and I'm curious your thoughts on standardized testing. And that people saying, like, we just got to get do away with it. And you actually share a quote in the book from Einstein about creativity being more important than knowledge. And students latch onto that and say, well, I just want to be creative. But I don't think you want your pilot or your surgeon to always be creative in what they're doing. Can we talk about that balance? You know, there's a real dichotomy there between creativity and doing the hard work of knowledge.
Yes. I think it's a false dichotomy in the sense that you're not going to be creative in a field unless you have a huge knowledge base about it. If none of us are going to be, Einstein's quotes, fine and all that, but if he hadn't had a tremendous knowledge of physics, he wouldn't have been able to step further. I mean, it's the standing on the shoulders of giants idea. If there hadn't been a Newton, there wouldn't have been an Einstein, those kinds of things. to be able to break the rules, you have to understand what the rules are, what the laws are. So I see it that you have to have a strong knowledge base before you can be creative. So the idea of, I mean, yeah, it's fine to have young children do coloring outside the lines, but they really are going to have to learn, you know, reading, writing, and arithmetic, as they say, and many other subjects in order to really make a contribution to knowledge. You don't become a creative coder in some programming language with never having steeped yourself in that programming language. So it just doesn't happen. There's no creativity without a knowledge base.
That's a great, great point. I really appreciated that because I feel like it's easy to, I think in the news, it's easy to publish articles that are sensational. And clearly if you read things like, oh, they're going to do away standardized testing, I mean, that gets me to click, you know, because that's something that we're very passionate about with our kids, trying to get them into college and get them prepared for, you know, a future life where I think testing is important. And so,
I think standardized testing has gotten a bad rap, but it's amazing how accurate it is. I mean, the problem with using it in as a selection criterion is, does it really say, I teach at a very selective school, Washington University in St. Louis, and so maybe we don't require scores anymore, they're optional. And a lot of schools are going to that. And I don't know, I feel like scores are useful information. People say, well, they're biased, they're discriminated against people without the advantages. And that's probably true, but everything we use, letters of reference, enrichment activities, well, poor kids work in the summers, rich kids can go off and do exciting things. And help the poor, whatever they do. I think they're really useful information. I'm sorry to see it's going away from them. The problem is selecting. If somebody gets the SAT test runs from 200 to 800, if somebody gets a 750 and somebody else gets a 700, or even a 650, there's really no difference. I mean, they can both succeed in college. And so using it as a selection of upper reaches, I don't think it's particularly useful. But if you're a Harvard, I mean, they've even talked about doing this. I don't think they ever will. But having some kind of screen, have a, you know, sort applicants into people who you think could profit by Harvard, who couldn't, probably half the people who apply could get, you know, and then pick them by lottery.
Yeah.
So they won't do that, I don't think. But because they really think they can pick this person over that person. And they pick on all kinds of criteria. I mean, when my children were doing their college tours, I remember at Stanford, the director who were giving the talk said, look, next year, the tuba player in our band graduated. Next year, we're going to find the smartest tuba player we can find and admit them to Stanford. And so they use all these criteria besides SATs, grades, everything else. They have other needs. So, but I think standardized test scores are useful. They really tell you. I mean, like if we didn't get standardized tests, we wouldn't know that during COVID, students really took a hit. Yep. That staying home for 2 years hurt them. They really got held back. And now everybody's trying to figure out how to make up for it. And was it a mistake to keep them back and so forth? That's a hard question, but we wouldn't even know there was a problem if we didn't have standards.
That's a great point. I never thought about that. That's really, really insightful. I want to talk about something we're working with our residents, and that's on the learning that comes from reflection on personal experience. And I'm curious what the research shows in that area and how listeners could apply it in their lives and in their work.
Well, I'm not sure what you, tell me what you mean by personal experience there.
Or the reflection on it. So instead of simply presenting a bunch of facts and data on how to treat a particular case or a case report, following up that next week and asking them to reflect on and maybe something they tried in the clinic or something they learned. So the reflection aspect, what's the research say about that? Because that was really fascinating to me in the book.
Yeah, no, the research base isn't strong on that. But the best advice is that the thought is it's very hard to study exactly because how do you get people, how do you know they're reflecting? But the thought is that what really is important is asking yourself. I mean, in a way, one of the things we advocate in the book that we haven't talked about yet is testing for learning. So let me detour for this and then come back to your question. So every time we test ourselves or we take a test, it doesn't just measure what we're learning, it changes it. And usually it improves it. So when I'm memorizing the names of the students in my class, I go through, sometimes I make flashcards with a picture on face on one side, name on the other, and just do them so I can get them all and call their names out if I bump into them on campus. And I just keep doing that all during the semester. So I know their names. I forget them probably by the end of the next semester, or at least some of them. But I have them at least for a while. I need them. And I reflect on, what do I know about this kid? You know, that's the kind of thing where I don't just recall the name, I recall where they're from and try to enrich my thoughts. So the idea is, I would think in dentistry, like being a doctor, in some sense, every patient you get is a test. Here's this person. They have this problem. What's the nature of the problem? What do I do about it? And at least in a lot of medicine, some things are ambiguous, and you have to figure it out. And then I think, especially in those cases where it's not straightforward, somebody comes in with a broken leg, okay, that's easy enough to diagnose and you know how to fix it. But for the things especially where it was unclear, reflecting on the case, what did I learn from it? Did I do things right? Did I do things wrong? What could I do better next time with this kind of case? I think those things are critically important. And we have good examples of that in the book. Say the neurosurgeon in one of the early chapters that you mentioned, where he had reflected on a new way to tie off knots to stop bleeding in the brain. And then a patient came in with a gunshot wound, and he was able to save the patient's life because he had developed this technique all on his own from reflecting on his prior experience. So I think reflection can be critical, but the evidence is mostly this kind of anecdotal evidence. But I think it's really important. You know, when you teach your course, at the end of the course, what did I do wrong? What did I get wrong? What should I change next time? I think every teacher does that almost automatically. I mean, I've changed even courses I teach for years. I've changed it every semester, always trying to improve it, dropping topics that didn't work and adding ones that did.
Are there tips you have to help part-time professors like me encourage students and residents to reflect more? Do you nudge them to, or do you give quiz questions more often, or what? I personally also love flashcards that work, that got me through dental boards. Yeah. So I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah. Flashcards are great. I think as a way to learn certain types of information. If you're a philosophy major, flashcards aren't going to help. What I do in my courses is if it's a really big course, I have to quiz. I teach, given my age, and I teach small seminars. I teach a freshman seminar every year on memory with a friend of mine. And we assign readings, and then we ask probe questions. And students for every class meeting write a 500-word essay, roughly 500 words. I tell them we'll read as much as they write. But and then we read those before class, and we orient the class discussion around questions and thoughts they've had, and we get them to defend what they thought. So that gets them to read. We require attendance, so they show up in class, not a given in college. and then we get them to discuss their ideas. And it worked really well. Then we lectured some after all that. But it puts the onus on them. And they really have to do the reading and reflect hard on it and write something more or less coherent for 500 words. And their writing gets much better during the course of the semester that we challenge them every class. So they're reflecting every class. And we tell them, this is why we're doing this. And you know, it's very unusual for a college class to require an essay for every class, but they get the hang of it. And usually by the end, most of them say, boy, I learned a lot from doing that.
I really like that. I really, really like that because I don't feel like I had enough of that. There were a few departments who did more oral exams, and so there was more reflection, and I was always more prepared for those than the midterm and then the final that were multiple choice. You just kind of crammed and, you know, did your best. I really, really like that. I love the part of the book we talk about an aversion to failure, and that sometimes we reinforce that as instructors. And that sometimes we think if we let students fail, they're going to learn those failures. Can you talk about why you think that's misguided?
Well, the evidence shows it's misguided. I believe that for a long time. There's a tradition in psychology that came out of behaviorism from B.F. Skinner, who had instructional programs in the 1950s and 1960s, which I partook in as an undergraduate. And the idea was you read something, that was kind of a good idea. Then you'd take a little test right afterwards. There'd be a sentence and you'd have to fill in a missing word or two. And so it was kind of a quiz. And so that's helpful. But the problem was you had the information in short-term memory and he didn't want you to fail because he believed errors will be stamped in. If you write down something that's wrong, that's what you'll remember. And it sounded reasonable to me. But the quiz is just too soon. You don't get much benefit if something happens immediately afterwards, and you don't have to, you need some effort at retrieval to make that learning stick. And so the research showed that even when you make errors, as long as they're corrected pretty soon afterwards, you don't have a problem. You remember the correct answer, not the wrong answer. So they never tested that assumption early on. But now it's been tested a number of times because people found it very counterintuitive that errors wouldn't be remembered. But they're not very much. As long as you give the correct answer after the test or either immediately, you know, if you're doing a program type thing, it can pop up immediately on your computer. But even if you just do it in the classroom and you give the answer right afterwards, it's been shown that the correct answers stick and the wrong answer just goes by the boards.
Now, a quick word from our sponsor.
When's the last time you evaluated your credit card processing statement? Our partners at Stacks are offering a free savings analysis for our listeners, where they will actually take your merchant statement with your current processor and show you where you're overpaying. Stacks has saved orthodontics practices over 40% per month on payment processing costs. So don't wait. Get your free savings analysis today and see how much you're overpaying for your credit card processing. Go to stackspayments.com/Burleson-seminars to schedule your savings analysis today. Plus, as a special offer for our podcast listeners, if you sign up today, you can get your first 2 months of payments processing costs waived from Stacks. Once again, that's stackspayments.com/Burleson-seminars. Stop overpaying. Start saving.
And now, back to the program.
Can we talk more about effort and retrieval? I thought that was a fascinating part of the book.
Sure. So quizzing is good. Testing yourself is good. But it needs to be a little time between learning and testing. Not too much, but it can't be just out of short-term memory. So what I've often advised students, say I used to teach introductory psychology for 25 years, and that was a big course, so couldn't do the quizzes type thing. But students would come in if they had a bad grade, and I would ask them how they studied. And I'd say, well, I read the book, I underlined, highlighted, went back and reread what I underlined and highlighted. And I'll say, well, look in the back of each chapter. There are all these key terms. Did you look at each key term and say, can I use that in a sentence? Did you try to write out a paragraph about unconditioned stimulus or whatever the term was? Nope. I didn't test themselves. So the illusion of learning that we talk about in the book is if I read something over and over, it seems so familiar, I really know it. But until you can answer questions about something, that tests whether you thought deeply about it, whether it stuck. And answering questions about it at the end of the chapter, if they're test questions or just key terms, turn those key terms into a question. What is unconditioned stimulus or whatever the term is? Then you test yourself. If you don't have a clue, you go back and look at that part of the chapter. You obviously, even though you read it three times, you didn't really learn that information.
Yeah, that would be one of those illusions of knowing, I think, that we mentioned in the book. Yeah. I really found that fascinating. I think there are so many ways we get tripped up by that, where we think we know it and then we experience it in the real world, or something unexpected comes up and we've never really accurately tested ourselves. It's a neat concept for me. I think something we're going to work with the residents on for sure in orthodontics. On page 109, you say something really interesting. You say, quote, our understanding of the world is shaped by a hunger for narrative that rises out of our discomfort with ambiguity and arbitrary events, end quote. I highlighted that and underlined it. Why is our urge to resolve ambiguity, do you think, so powerful? And how could we be more accurate about the judgments we make and the actions we take when something unexpected or surprising shows up?
Yes. Yeah, I like that quote too, even though I didn't write it. but talk a little bit about narrative first, that basically human beings are natural storytellers. I mean, we like to tell stories to each other. And when you describe a case history of a patient, well, that's a story. Here's the problem. Here was the solution we tried. Here's what worked. Here's what didn't. I'm making this up because I don't know that much about dentistry except being a patient. We like to, things are very memorable if you can put them in stories. If that's one problem with something like calculus, it's very hard to put into a story. The best teachers can do it. And so if you're teaching something that lends itself to narrative, you're much better off. And if you can put things that way, we have a natural tendency to remember stories. Lily Tomlin said the reason we have speech is because we were born to gossip. But that's an example of narrative where they stick. But I think if you can teach like that so you have a narrative, you're much better off. And if you can convert what you want to say into some kind of narrative, and if you can also use concrete figures of speech, that abstractions are very hard to learn. It's much easier to learn if you can make things concrete. Big literature in my field on that. So let's see. Now, let me come back to the other part of your question or observation. Remind me.
Yeah, just how we can be more accurate about the judgments we make. When something surprising happens, you know, how can we be more accurate and not rely back on that false sense of knowing?
Yeah, it's very hard. I mean, it's just trial and error at that point. You need to experience this. If you have, you know, a patient who comes in and you say, I can't categorize this problem. There's pain, but it doesn't seem to be this, doesn't seem to be that. What is it? Doctors often fall back on, oh, it's functional, meaning it's in their head or something. And it's never very satisfying to the patient. No, it's not in my head, it's in my gum. So it's just, you know, there is no magic bullet there. You have to be, the problem is overcome. You can be sure you know what it is and then be wrong. I think having a humility so that you say, I need to try out several things here. I can't just pick the first thing that I think it is and assume I'm right, especially if it doesn't seem to be helping. So you just have to be guided by the experience as it's ongoing and try not just to stick with your first hypothesis if it doesn't seem to be working. That's one big problem that people in medicine tell me that sometimes happens, that they'll stick to a diagnosis even though the patient's not getting better with the standard treatment.
It's very true. And I think we become professional students and we become very fearful of failure. We always want to have the right answer. And so that experience thing is just, you have to, I feel like, take time and be really, right. Yeah. I scribbled notes in the margin. I hope it's, I always feel bad. A friend of mine is a book publisher. He's like, don't write in your cloth bound books, but I always, there's tons of notes in the margins. And so I apologize, but I wrote all over it.
No, that's fine.
There's a great quote on page 159 where you say, quote, mastery, especially of complex ideas, skills, and processes, is a quest. It's not a grade on a test. Something bestowed by a coach, or a quality that simply seeps into your being with old age and gray hair, end quote. I really like that because it shows how we need to be mindful of how mastery really works. And I know there's a lot of popular concepts on it takes 10,000 hours, or it takes all that, you know, like maybe if you're Picasso, it probably takes a lot fewer than 10,000 hours. But, you know, I guess the question, if there is one, is how can we be more mindful of that? The difference between mastery and simply getting good grades on a test, or how could we encourage ourselves as lifelong learners, or our employees, or our coworkers, or our students, to embrace that and see that.
Yeah, I think it takes a lifetime experience to really gain mastery in certain things. I mean, the 10,000 hours came out of work by Anders Ericsson, and it's true for certain skills, no doubt. And that's Malcolm Gladwell made that popular, and. Erickson claimed Gladwell misquoted him there, but anyway, I don't know the truth of the matter. I think you don't gain, you know, when I got my PhD, okay, you think, well, you've mastered psychology. No, you've barely scratched the surface. It's not until you start teaching that you really learn things much better. And, you know, you just keep, if you're a lifelong learner, you just keep learning more and more. And then from that, all that learning, you hope comes wisdom. You have all these experiences, have all these experiences with different kinds of students, with different kinds of courses. And you just think, you hope you get better. You probably reach some asymptote at some point, but you just hope you keep getting better. And you have to keep reflecting on your experience, always asking yourself, what could I have done differently? What could I do better? How could I have done this better? You know, advising graduate students, teaching residents, whatever the task is, just always reflecting on it, dealing with patients too. I know my daughter is a doctor, and she said going through medical school that some students would have these great grades, just rise to the top of the class, but she says, I wouldn't trust them to be my doctor in a million years. They didn't have that quality that she thought you would want in a doctor, of empathy and being able to take the patient's perspective and so forth. They did great in Claire classes, but it's not a totally independent kind of knowledge. Obviously, you have to gain, you know, it's kind of like creativity. You have to gain this background of knowledge, but then it takes more than that to be a good dentist. It takes other kinds of people skills too.
Yeah. What advice would you have for a new professor or a practice owner who has an employee, or maybe they're looking at working with another doctor who might be lacking some of those empathy skills? Any advice on how to identify that and maybe help coach anyone along?
I don't know how you do that, except trying to get people to put themselves in the patient's place. I mean, often doctors write these articles about when they became a patient. Oh my God, I didn't realize how bad the hospital was. They're waking you up all night. And I'm thinking, yeah. Everybody who's been in the hospital loves that, except the doctors.
Yeah.
So trying to have that experience, and as a dentist, I'm sure you go see other dentists for your own teeth. So you do have that experience routinely. So I think that helps. And doctors, I'm surprised sometimes they don't go see other doctors that much. And it's like, just like a lawyer is their own worst client. They're their own client. Same thing with doctors, I'm sure. Yes. You need to go get the outside perspective from somebody else. And so same thing with teaching. It's harder because there's what's called the curse of knowledge. The number of studies. Once you have knowledge, you can't remember what it was like to be a brand new learner where you didn't have it. And so I think in math, that's a huge problem. But I've talked to people who teach calculus who just can't believe students come in where they really are, because I was that student. I did fine in calculus, but boy, it was hard work for my part. Whereas some people seem to have a natural ability in it, but most people don't. And so having a math professor who can empathize with the students, who can remember what it was like, and it's very hard. Once you have the knowledge, it's very hard to put yourself back into the state of abysmal ignorance that you were when you came in as a student. So that's true of all of us. I mean, I try, when I teach, not to use big words, not to use jargon, or if I do have to use jargon, to explain what it means in common terms if I can. Just never use a big word when a small word will do, kind of philosophy. Whereas a lot of professors like to show off their vocabulary and their erudition and give a lecture that's all but incomprehensible. I mean, I've heard psychology colloquially that I should have understood that I wouldn't have a clue what was going on because the person was not in my field and was so far down some path that using all kinds of words I didn't know, even though I'm a psychologist. So it can happen to any of us.
Yeah, I see that with not just new dental students and residents, but with patients as well, where we kind of speak at this level and we don't realize that we need to bridge that gap between where our knowledge is and theirs. There's lies. That's great advice. Any advice for any parents listening on helping your daughter get into medical school or become a doctor? Did she always want to be a doctor? I'm just curious what that was like.
Medical school is hard. There's no doubt about it. And the whole process is just, oof. I mean, I didn't have any desire to be a doctor. She, her senior year in high school, at the very end, the last month, when the seniors had senioritis at this particular high school in town, they had students do some special project, shadow. So she shadowed a doctor. One of her friends was father was a cardiologist. So she shadowed him for a month. And he was very kind to her. He let her go see all kinds of stuff and be with him and explain to her what was going on. And that's where she tells me she got the fascination with it. It set her on a hard road and but now she's doing just great. She's in New York at Mount Sinai Hospital. She's a gastroenterologist in general and then a liver specialist. But she kept me informed the whole way.
I think that's awesome. I'm just always fascinated of the children of, esteemed and just highly successful parents, kind of how they, how they navigate their own path. And, she did medicine instead of psychology. And I'm just curious how that was as a parent, seeing that, all that hard work blossom into a great, great result.
Yeah, no, it was gratifying. She complained a lot along the way, so I got to hear that part of it too.
Well, on behalf of me and all future patients, we're glad she put in the hard work, because it's literally life and death. So we're grateful for all of our physicians and all the healthcare providers. So I always get to joke and say it's just teeth, right? So I work at Children's Mercy Hospital. They have a cleft lip and palate team where we get to help out, but the rest of the time it's like it's just a tooth. We're gonna be just fine. So I've really loved the chance to get to talk to you. We're gonna make sure everyone has a link to the book. I want to make sure sure we get any final thoughts from you on the program, maybe where listeners can find more about your lab or what you're up to and researching.
Yeah, if you just Google my name, you get to my website, and all my publications are on my website, and some are probably baffling, but others are pretty general. So that would be a place to start. Yep. And there are a number of other good books about learning and memory. Dan Willingham is a good person to read. He's more on K-12 education, and he writes a column for the Wall Street Journal. So he would be another good person to look at.
Excellent. Yeah, we'll post a link to his work in the show notes. And then I can't leave without saying that the book is so well referenced and researched with more reading recommendations. And the last chapter is worth its weight in gold because it's a summary of all of the strategies that we can use in our own lives to be lifelong learners. And I do believe all this should be taught in fourth or fifth grade. And clearly it's helping me be at least a somewhat better adjunct professor at the dental school. So thank you, Roddy. It's just been a tremendous honor.
Well, it's great to talk to you, Justin.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Burleson Box. And a special thank you to Roddy Roediger for coming on the program. If you like what you heard, please share us with a friend or colleague. Subscribe on whatever app you use to download podcasts. And we'll see you again next time right here inside another episode of the Burleson Box.
Are you trying to increase your treatment plan close rates while also increasing revenue? How can you do both for your dental practice without burning out an already burdened staff? The answer? Remote dental monitoring. You need a trusted HIPAA-compliant app that helps you and your staff work smarter, not harder. This needs to be an easy-to-use, easy-onboard app that your patients will find fun to use and will increase their engagement and success with aligners. You need the InHand Dental App. The InHand Dental App allows you to engage with your patients in real time, send individual and batched messages, and solve problems to increase compliance without using up chair time. The result? Happy patients, happy staff, and happy practices. With more revenue and the ability to do more starts. With prices starting as low as $149 a month, it's perfect for a growing aligner business. Check us out and learn more at InHandDental.com. Plus, mention Burleson for a 20% off discount on your subscription when you contact us. That's InHandDental.com.